You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
This summer, click into cordless power with Memorial Day savings at the Home Depot. Tackle more than half an acre of grass with the convenience and gas-like power of the Ryobi 40-volt battery-powered mower. And keep your flower beds looking fresh with the 40-volt cordless string trimmer. Then clear leaves and debris with the 40-volt leaf blower. No cords, no gas, no hassle. Click into Memorial Day savings happening now at the Home Depot and on homedepot.com. How doers get more done.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
The Podcast Playground.
Hooray! Welcome to the Taking a Walk podcast, music history on foot. No podcast covers music storytelling like Taking a Walk. If you like what you hear, please share it with your friends. We're available at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podcast Playground, or wherever you get your podcasts. On Taking a Walk, Buzz Knight covers all genres and eras, from new artists to Hall of Famers and everyone in between. On this episode, we welcome an artist who's been working at his craft his entire life. Johnny Polonsky is a multi-instrumentalist, a singer-songwriter, and a record producer. He's worked with Johnny Cash, and he's been produced by Rick Rubin. His new release on Loose Groove Records is called The Rise of the Rebel Angels. We welcome Johnny Polonsky on the next Taking a Walk.
Well, Yakshimash, Johnny. Thanks for being on Taking a Walk, albeit virtually.
All right. Thanks for having me.
So congrats on The Rise of the Rebel Angels, your eighth album. And it's amazing thinking that you already have your ninth album in the can already. What's your creative process that leads to so much great work?
Well, I mean, the first record I put out came out in the mid-90s, so 8, 9, that's not that many, really. But I just write a lot. You know, I'll go through phases, too. Sometimes I'm always kind of messing around with whether it's guitar or keyboards or just kind of playing around with ideas or working on – I'm always sort of tinkering in some way. Sometimes it's very the full thrust where I'm like really actively writing, either just because I feel like it or because I have a project that I'm working towards. I just like doing it, so I do it. You know what I mean? And it's something, I don't know, I've always just been drawn to writing songs and making music, and it's still endlessly fascinating to me. It's sort of like that cliche of like, the more you know, the more you realize how much you don't know. And it's just mysterious and fun. And like, I mean, even if it's very, it can be anything you want it to be, you know, it's like, and it's what I do is basically just chords, melody, and words, you know what I mean? And with that simple, it's not even really a formula, it's just three ingredients. Like, you can kind of do anything. And I love all sorts of music. And I love, I don't like being bored, you know, that's something that is a constant. I get frustrated very easily. So I'm always looking for ways to stay engaged, and I mean, just in life in general and in the music I make, just finding ways to just keep things going and keep getting better and keep, you know, getting better at the craft and just learning from the people. I have lots of heroes and just people that really inspire me and, you know, continuously blow me away, whether they're alive or dead or friends or whatever. You got to do something. You know what I mean? Like, what are you going to do? Just like work your dumb job and pay your rent. You know what I mean? Like, we're lucky people that get to make stuff. I mean, anybody can make stuff, really. You know what I mean? So I just decided I'm going to do it, you know?
Do you remember that first time you picked up a guitar?
I don't remember the very first time, but I was in fourth grade, and my teacher, Mr. Spangenberger, used to, on Fridays, bring out his acoustic guitar, and he would play us, leaving on a jet plane, John Denver, and he'd do like you know, old folk songs, Ear Canal, stuff like that, and sometimes Beatle tunes. And I was completely in love with the Beatles, like ever since I was five, like long before I started playing. My parents had a pretty good record collection, pretty big record collection, and I gravitated towards the red and blue greatest hits of the Beatles that came out sometime in the 70s. Yeah, I was completely enamored of the red one. I was totally obsessed. I, you know, brought it upstairs and had like my little, you know, portable record player, and that's all I did was like listen to She Loves You over and over. And when Mr. Spangenberger started playing, I don't know, I don't even know if it was necessarily a light bulb going off my head. But it was just sort of like, oh, like you can actually do this, you know? And so I wanted to learn how to play guitar. And my hands were too small. I was only, I guess, 9. So he suggested my parents to get me a baritone ukulele, which is the top 4 strings of the guitar. And so they got me that, and I just taught myself. Like I just got a Mel Bay chord book, and you know, I borrowed Mr. Spangenberger's he had this awesome book of lyrics with like the chords written over it. And you know, I just, I totally went to town. Like I would do it for hours, like hours, you know what I mean? Like when you're a little kid and the kind of focus you have when you've got just nothing, you know what I mean? Like you're just living your life and going to school. So I was completely obsessed, and that was an incredible feeling. So I don't remember the first time I played a guitar. I'm sure he let me, you know, sit down and mess around with it. But after I learned, you know, a few songs, you know, I would get up and perform for the class too, doing like Duran Duran and stuff like that. But that was one thing too. Like it's sort of interesting in retrospect. Like I didn't really buy that many records growing up, but my mom would always buy me sheet music. Like I would ask, I would want the sheet music, which is kind of cool. Like it was sort of strange to me realizing, you know, years later, like my record collection wasn't huge really, like at the start, but I wanted to do it, you know, like I wanted to, like I watched, you know, tons of MTV. Like radio was around, but I didn't really listen to radio so much. It was really, I was the, you know, the prime candidate for MTV generation. I was, 8 when it came out. That's all I did. I would like sit down in the basement and like, I don't know. I remember distinctly, I would watch like 6-8 hours of TV like every day. Like, I don't know how I like managed to fit that all in, like, and still go to school. Like I watched so much TV growing up. I don't even own a TV now, but like I learned so much just from watching MTV, and you know, theme songs were great back then. I mean, I don't know how they are now, but like they were really good, you know, like Good Times and the Jeffersons. And I mean, Quincy Jones wrote the theme to Sanford and Son. You know what I mean? God, Welcome Back, Cotter, John Sebastian, incredible themes. So I learned, I had a great guitar teacher too. This guy, Jeff Jacobs, who I studied with for about 2 or 3 or 4 years, maybe. And he taught me some theory, and, you know, he was a huge influence too. Like he turned me on to Frank Zappa and Mothers of Invention and was just, you know, and he would just kick my ass. Like, I never practiced. And he was just like an older, you know, he was a teacher. He was my teacher. And he was just somebody that, even though I really never practiced, like, it was just, I learned a ton just from being around him and the few times I did practice, you know. But what was the question?
Well, you grew up in an amazing area in Chicago, and you got to visit in your teen years some pretty amazing venues. Talk about what it was like being a teenager going to the Metro or to the Riviera or the Aragon. What was that like?
Incredible. I grew up in Wilmette, which is two cities north of Chicago along the lake. There's Chicago, Evanston, where Eddie Vedder's from, and Wilmette. And one of the great things about Wilmette is that it's the last stop on the L train, you know, the train, the subway, whatever. So I would, I mean, starting around 12 years old, I would go into Chicago. I'll tell my parents I was going to the library, but really I had this older friend named Cleo Patrick. That was his real name. I was about 12. He was like 28, 29, something like that. And he was a Jimi Hendrix imitator. I was completely obsessed with Jimi Hendrix. And so I would take the train like 2 hours, like deep into the ghetto, like the worst part of Chicago is Jackson and Karloff. Just like, yeah, it's just like a really bad section. And we would just hang out in the basement, and he had like a whole wall of vintage Marshall stacks and old Stratocasters and fuzz pedals. And that was incredible. And so I'd do stuff like that. I would go to, I mean, not quite when I was 12, but like a little older, I would go to shows, at the Metro. I spent like years at that club. I remember seeing the Chili Peppers in 1988. That was a mind blower. And I used to, I guess around 14 or so, I started going in the afternoon. Like, I would show up for sound check, not at the Metro, but like a bigger place like the Riviera. I would just dress all, I would just dress in black anyway back then, but like I would just dress in black because I noticed all the security guards dressed in black. So even though I was 14, like, nobody questioned me. Like, they just assumed I was like a short security guard or something. I would go to sound checks, and like I'd start making tapes, and I would, you know, use it as an excuse to go backstage and meet people. I was just telling someone this the other day. I went to Sonic Youth sound check on the Dirty Tour in early 90s. I was much older by then. I was like 19 or 20. But I went backstage after the sound check and talked to Thurston Moore. I was like, can you get me on the list? He's like, why? You're already here. I was like, I know, but I need to go home and have dinner with my mom. And so I did. Like, I left and went and had dinner with my mom and came back for the show. And he put me on the list. A total gent. It was an incredible show. But yeah, I mean, Chicago, I don't know how it is so much now. I haven't been back in a while, but growing up there was really incredible. The Riviera, the Aragon, which I ended up playing, opening for Audioslave like many years later, which was incredible. The Vic, I used to live kitty corner from the Vic on Belmont. Yeah, great venues. It was a great time in music and in the culture in general. But yeah, I was really lucky. Like, if I had lived in a different city, even one city over, it would have been a lot harder to get into the city. Well, I mean, there was still like the Amtrak, but that was because I lived a block from that too. That was just a lot more expensive. That was like $8 a ride, I think, each way. And the L was like, I think, like 75 cents or something like that.
You know, you almost created sort of an MBA program by accident with your crazy 411 calls that you used to make. Can you talk about some of those 411 calls? I love that story.
Yeah, I mean, back when people had landlines and you'd call 411 directory information, you'd just say what city you wanted and give the person's name. That was more like, I was around, I guess, 17 or 18. I was listening to Tom Waits, the album Frank's Wild Years, which I really loved. And I really fell in love with the guitar player, Mark Rebo. His playing was just incredible to me. And it was just so creative and outlandish and really funny and I just had a feeling. I mean, this is my insane teenage thinking, but I was like, I bet he's really nice and really smart and really funny. And he's got to live somewhere, right? You know, and he's a, you know, he's legendary now, but back then, you know, not so much, early 90s. So I just called 411 and, you know, I think I just assumed he lived in New York or something. You know, back then, pre-internet, you didn't really have any information on anybody, especially if they were a little more obscure. And he was in the phone book, so I just called him up and made friends and, you know, told him I was a teenager from Chicago and I was a huge fan. I would just pepper him with questions, and he was real gracious and helpful and answer everything. And, you know, I'd started sending him tapes, and he loved them. It was, and that was an incredible, too, just having the support and encouragement of somebody older than me who was way more experienced and someone I really looked up to and whose music I really loved. And, you know, in retrospect, like, I think it's natural if you're really serious about doing something to seek out a mentor. That wasn't, I wasn't intentionally doing that. And I wasn't, it did end up being networking, I guess, but I wasn't thinking about that at all. It's just like, I love these people. Like, I want to know them, you know, like when you're a kid and you think, cause you know someone's music, you know them, or that you want to know them. And a lot of times it does work out that the art and the person are very similar. Sometimes not, but I have very few experiences where it went awry. And I mean, a lot of those people, some of them are you know, are old dear friends now. Like I was a huge Frank Zappa fan. I remember getting, stealing a couple hundred bucks from my parents' sock drawer so I could buy scalped first row center tickets for his last tour in Chicago. And a couple years later, I called directory assistance for Scott Tunis, the bass player, just because I would watch this the live video, Does Humor Belong in Music, over and over again. Me and my brother would watch that. And he, you know, Scott, out of everybody, for some reason, just seemed very extra vibrant and funny and just an incredible player. And I don't know. I was 18. I was like, I want to know that guy. So I called him up, and he's one of my oldest, dearest friends. You know, we became great friends. And that's the thing, you know. It's like music really does bring people together, you know. I mean, these are, like, really ridiculous circumstances. But I don't know. I never understood why people, no one else really was doing that, you know. And now it's easy. It's never been easier to reach people, but it's also never been harder to reach people. So all you have to do is just ignore an email.
I think it's a fantastic story because it shows your passion for your work and it shows that you've got some balls. I love it, you know?
Yeah, I was just in love with music and really enamored of these musicians. And I just wanted to know them and learn from them, and, you know.
Tell me what your experience was like at the Berklee School of Music in Boston.
I mean, Berklee, I just went to... Let's see. Okay, so I graduated high school. I went to a semester of Northern Illinois in DeKalb, Illinois. And I just slept most of the time because I had mono. And I also was completely uninterested in school. And that was right when Nirvana hit. And I was just, you know, it was just a really incredible time. And that's really when I went into overdrive, just like calling people up and sending them my tapes and, was, you know, recording a ton and just, very fertile creative period. And after a semester, I quit and joined this band called White Fat Farm, which is an incredible band. They were a lot older than me. Well, at the time, you know, I was 18. They were like mid-20s, late-20s. I learned so much from being in that band. No one's ever heard of them. It's like they never released any music, but incredible songs and just... this guy, Mike Smith, who's the singer and songwriter. I mean, I would still be writing songs and playing guitar, obviously, if I hadn't been involved with them. But he's been as influential on me as anybody, John Lennon or Jimi Hendrix or whoever. I did that for about 7 months and quit. And I was just sort of floating around. And my aunt from Boston came to visit. And I was just sort of aimless, not knowing what to do with myself. And she suggested going to Berklee, which I really had no interest in, but by that point, I'd been a band with David Bowie and Reese Gabrels and the Sales Brothers. I knew Reeves Gabrales lived in Boston. I think we might have already been friends by then. I forget. He was another person that was a huge early supporter. I called him up and was just, you know, would send him tapes and same thing as Rebo, just like, you know, ask him 1,000 questions and he would answer everything and just very, very supportive of what I was doing. So I was like, yeah, I'll go to Boston. You know, I had no intention of really, I didn't care about the school. I just wanted to be close to Reeves. So that's what I did. So I went there a couple semesters and I went to classes and everything, but apparently they've put a lot of money into it and it's supposed to be a good school now, but it was a dump when I was there. I had a guitar teacher who suggested I quit. So I really didn't care. My roommate had left, so I had this huge dorm all to myself, and all I did was smoke weed and listen to Pavement and My Bloody Valentine and record on my 4-track and hang out with my friends. And I hooked up with Reeves. Like, he was really, really great. Just took me around and introduced me to everybody in his circle. So I had a community and I started playing with other people. And yeah, that was a great time. Yeah. So the school, you know, I really didn't learn much of anything from Berkeley, but I had a good time.
So you did the infamous iPhone demos. Do you think now, if you did those iPhone demos, that because of technology changing with the phone, they would have been much different at all?
I mean, you know, when you're a kid, especially, like, you just use whatever you have at your disposal, you know? Sometimes I wonder what it'd be like being a teenager now. It's got to be so bewildering. Like, there's just endless choices of everything and so much craziness in the world. More than ever. But I feel really lucky that all I had was a cassette 4-track and a broken mic from Radio Shack and a handful of instruments at home. And it's, you know, limitations force you to use your imagination and to, when you have, you know, there's nothing wrong with technology. Like, every tool is just a tool. So it's great. Like, I've got Pro Tools now on my computer, and you know, I've got a program that's got quite literally, I think, like 10,000 sounds or something like that. So it's amazing to have all that at your disposal, but it was really great for me, especially learning how to make things work with very few options. So I don't know, like, I like both, but I do miss, I'm always kind of trying to get back to the state of mind of when I was just starting out. And, you know, my mindset back then was just, I'm just messing around. Like, I'm just trying stuff. I think that's a great way to approach things. When you don't take things too seriously, then you can really do anything. You can go anywhere and you're not bound to any style or any kind of anything, you know, especially like once it's easy. Like, once you start putting stuff out in the world to pay too much attention to how people might perceive you or what you've done in the past that might have gotten a good reaction or whatever. Cause none of it matters, really. I mean, it's great. Like I put stuff out because I want to reach people, and I love when I do, when they respond positively. You know, the point is just me doing my thing, and regardless of like how people respond, you know, sometimes they like it, sometimes they don't. But all that really matters is just me living my life and just like doing what I want to do, which sounds overly simplistic, but can be very difficult to really pull off sometimes.
What's your take on artificial intelligence now in and around recording music?
It's interesting. I've listened to a few of those tracks. You know, it's kind of funny, you know, hearing whatever, like John Lennon singing an Oasis song or something like that. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what happens with it. I don't have any, I mean, some people are freaking out about it the same way people freaked out about drum machines. Like, they're going to replace drummers, and it's just another tool. Hopefully they won't replace humans on the planet. But, other than that, I don't really have much of an opinion on AI. It's still such early days. I mean, I check it out every once in a while, but I'm not overly obsessed with technology. Like, I never have been. Like, I love guitars, and, you know, I have enough knowledge with computers and Pro Tools to do what I need to do. But I'm not like a Pro Tools whiz, and I'm not a programming whiz. I just know enough to do what I want to do, and sometimes not even that much, you know. So I'm not, you know, technology is interesting, but after a certain point, I don't really care.
Your first moment, you met Johnny Cash and then ultimately worked with him. Tell me about that experience.
I never met him. I had the opportunity to meet him. I went to a Cash show at the Pantages Theater in L.A. Beck was opening. That was an incredible experience. I was just out in L.A. visiting. I wasn't living there yet, but I was already on American, on the label. And Rick came up to me and asked if I wanted to meet Johnny Cash. I was really drunk, and I foolishly said no. Internally, I was like, oh, I can't meet Johnny Cash. I'm too drunk, you know, which is ridiculous, like thinking that, you know, Johnny Cash is going to judge you for being too drunk. It's like thinking that Lemmy's going to judge you for being too high on speed or something. So I really wish I would have met him, but I didn't. But I ended up playing, like, years later, like 20 years ago almost, 2004, 2005. I was living in L.A., and I'd reconnected with Rick Rubin. He asked me to play on – there was a – I think like 60 unreleased songs in various forms of completion. It was me and Smokey Hormel, who's a great guitar player and bass player. He's played with Beck and Tom Waits and Mike and Ben Mont from Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, and this great guitar player named Matt Sweeney. All of us were just in Rick's basement, which was converted to a studio. And for about, I guess, 2 weeks before Christmas and 2 weeks after Christmas, we just plowed through about 60 songs. That was an incredible experience. You know, I mean, just playing with those players alone was really amazing. It's just so easy. That was one of the things that was so surprising, I guess. Well, I mean, not so surprising, but like a pleasant surprise. It's like, wow, this is like so easy to play with these people. You know, it's just very... Everyone's just so good, and there's no egos, and people just do it. You know what I mean? There's no stumbling over doubt or trepidation or anything like that. Just playing music. And a lot of those songs never got released either. A bunch did. So I'm on, I think it's American 4 and 5, and which is maybe like 20 songs or 25 songs. But yeah, there's a bunch that's still unreleased. That was an amazing experience. That was surreal. I mean, I grew up listening to Johnny Cash. You know, I remember driving around Wilmette, you know, just like listening to the Sun recordings. And I played on the last song he ever wrote, like the 409, or is it 309? I always forget. There's a Beach Boys song, the 309? 409.
409.
Like the 309, that's the Johnny Cash song. 409 is the Beach Boys song.
You must have learned a lot from Rick Rubin in your time with him. What did he teach you about sort of looking inward?
I mean, I learned a ton from being around Rick. For me, the most obvious things that come to mind are just, you know, when making a record, just surrounding yourself with the right people. He just hires... I mean, there's a lot of great musicians in the world. There's a lot of people that can do it. It's just about hiring the right people for the particular project. And he's just really good at, it's like a casting director. Like, you know, it's just like you get the right people for the part and it's pretty smooth sailing. Like he doesn't really say much because he hires the right people that just kind of know what to do. But when something needs to be said, he's very clear and direct and you know exactly what he means. He's very articulate. And especially for a non-musician, like I think he plays a little guitar, but like he's basically a non-musician, but he's way more articulate when it comes to talking about music or arrangements than almost every musician I've ever played with. I also used to, I was the guitar tech for Audioslave for a couple of years, and I was around when, that's how Rick and I reconnected, because he was producing their second record, and I had become their guitar tech. So I was there, you know, every day when he would be in pre-production with them. So that was really interesting watching him dissect the songs and obviously they're great songwriters anyway, great band, but he would just make suggestions just to mess around and experiment and see if they couldn't make it better, if they tried this or this, if move this here, maybe try a bridge, maybe take away a bridge, you know, all these little suggestions. I guess that's it, really. It's just surrounding yourself with the right people and just communicating very directly. And there's never, he's a really nice person. You know what I mean? Like, you never get there's not a shred of like dictator vibe or anything like that. But he's very much in control. Like, it kind of carries this weight of like, he's the man. But he's not arrogant, you know? So it's nice to, that's what you want. In that kind of situation, like, you want to feel like somebody's steering the ship, even if we're all like a part of it and contributing.
You've had such a fascinating group of people that you've been around through your career. I think of, you know, Frank Black and Pete Yorn and, you know, just this incredibly, you know, diverse group. Is there somebody that you've recently discovered that's of a more vintage nature that you just got turned on to? And is there someone conversely brand new that you've just gotten turned on to?
This great Japanese guitar player. He's dead now. Takashi Terayuchi, this amazing surf guitar player, great. I mean, like, tons of albums. Like, they're all on Spotify and they're all in Japanese, so I have no idea what the titles are. But excellent guitar player and like really creative and just strange, wonderful. As far as contemporary bands, I really recently fell in love with Fiddler. I love this band Fiddler. They've got a bunch of records. Just a great, really energetic, fun, kind of aggro punk band, very melodic, from San Diego, I believe. I like them a lot.
So when you think of the beauty of live performance, and you're going to be, you just recently, did the show in Brooklyn, and I know you've got other shows going on. Does the electricity of live performance ever change in a different way for you?
I mean, it's always different depending on the venue and the crowd and but whatever. Like I mean, you mean in terms of like now versus a few decades ago?
Yeah.
Not really. I mean, maybe I'm more confident now, and or just less full of doubt, which I guess is the same thing. You know what I mean? It's like you just go up and do it. You know what I mean? And not in a jaded way. It's just like I still get nervous sometimes. But I think it's a good thing. It's really just sort of getting charged up. And I mean, nervous might even be the wrong word. I get nervous if like, I feel like my voice isn't up to par, or if the band doesn't know that, if I don't have confidence in the band or whatever. But like, I'm playing with really good players right now, and I feel really good. So we just go up and do it. You know, that's it, really. So I really enjoy it. I love playing live. I really want to get on tour. That's the ideal. It's just so expensive, you know. It's really expensive to tour, and there's obviously got to be a demand, or unless you're getting on like a tour with a bigger act. So that's the quest right now. It's just trying to get on the road.
How did you get so comfortable in front of a camera?
Aren't we all in front of a camera now?
You know? Yeah, true.
That's just life. I don't know. I mean, I'm not. It's. I mean, right now it's not a big deal. But like in general, like they're very unnatural situations. But yeah, I mean, cameras are everywhere now.
So when you think about the ninth album coming out, it's going to come out. It's later in the fall, right?
Either the fall or early next year. One of the two.
And. Do you feel it takes a different turn than your previous work?
Yeah, there's a lot of guest stars on it. There's a bunch of guest drummers, and there's an orchestra on two tunes, which I've never done before. It's got some of my favorite musicians of all time that are playing on it, which is sort of, and I didn't mean for it to happen. It just kind of ended up that way. You know, it's a little more succinct and focused in a way than this most recent record. Not one's not like better or worse, or, you know, it's just a different thing. Yeah, I'm excited for the next one to come out. I'm writing for the a 10th one. You know what I mean? Like, I'm excited for all of them. Like, I want to put them out and have as many people hear them as possible. But I'm always, like, looking forward to the next one. It never goes fast enough either. I wish, you know, like in the 60s, you know, I mean, Beatles, Jimi Hendrix, people would release 2 or 3 records a year, you know? I wish we could do that now. I mean, we can, but it's just like, it's, you can do whatever you want, really, especially these days. It's not just about releasing music. I've been releasing music for the last 10 years on my own, but it's also trying to reach people, and it just takes time to, you know, getting, a song license in a movie or a TV show or something like that, or getting on a tour, you know, to really like build and get some kind of momentum. Well, I guess it's really more career stuff than, you know, it's all interrelated, but it's, to me, it's really just about reaching as many people as I can. There's a part of me that just wants to release music all the time, regardless of anything. But I don't want to just release stuff in a vacuum. Like, I've done that, and it's just, it's sort of depressing. I mean, it's always great to, I love what I do, and I'm always excited about what I put out. Like, I don't put anything out unless I'm really excited about it. But, you know, you want to reach people too. And doing it on my own, it's expensive, man. I mean, it's expensive anyway, but now it's expensive for somebody else who's not me. So that's a good thing.
What are some causes that are important to you?
Making the planet habitable. You know, the homeless problem is ridiculous. I used to live in LA. Like, it was like I think it was like 40 or 50,000 people homeless in LA, which is completely insane. I mean, it's insane anywhere that exists, but there's quite a bit in New York. And I just dropped something off at the Bowery Mission. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things that deserve attention, but those are the two that really spring to mind for me.
What advice would you give to somebody listening to this that's a musician just in the early stages of their career?
Just play what you want to play. Play what you want to hear. Like, never stop being the listener or the fan, the audience, you know, because you're the first audience member. You know, it should be music that you actually want to listen to, which sounds strange, but, like, that's a common thing to, for one reason or another, to make music for reasons other than just because you love it, especially once you start getting a little feedback from people. Just make the music that you want to hear. Plus, it'll be way more personal that way, and that's going to be what people will respond to, is when there's something genuine, when you can, you know, you just, even non-musicians, everybody, anyone can tell, like, when there's a real palpable sense of joy or a sense of discovery or, you know what I mean? Like, you can just tell when somebody's doing it for real, or whether they're just, you know, it might be very good or a well-made product or whatever, but you can tell when there's, like, no real genuine enthusiasm. Or I can, anyway. Like, I feel like, yeah, people can, whether they realize it or not. You know? So just do what you really want to do, you know? Do it because you love it, not because you're trying to get something out of it.
Well, thanks for the music that you bring to us. That's raw, it's authentic. Obviously, it's something that brings you joy, but it brings us joy. And thanks for everything that you bridge together through all your musical influence. I absolutely love that as well, Johnny.
Oh, thanks, Buzz. I appreciate the kind words. Thank you, man.
Thank you for being on Taking a Walk.
Thank you for having me.
Taking a Walk with Buzz Knight is available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.